another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Bob Scott, former co-founder of the Kansas City Fellowship and the author of three books, the latest is Some Said They Blundered, Breaking My Decades of Silence on Mike Bickle, The Kansas City Prophets, and The International House of Prayer. Well, Bob, it's good to be back, and I'm going to have you break your silence just a bit more. We're going to dive into John Paul Jackson. I've been asked by multiple people over the years to go deeper with him, and honestly, I want to. It's not that I don't. There are just so many names in the history building up to this. Yeah. But I recently put something out. I don't know if you saw it, but I did a thing on John Paul Jackson as it related to the California prophecy.
Right.
And what I was trying to show is that this is nothing new, nothing original. This is just a repeat of various things. And in the comment feeds, people were saying, well, why didn't you mention Prophet X or Prophet Y? They both right. did the same thing.
Right.
And so I think this podcast is going to be about John Paul Jackson, but more to the point, it's going to be about the fact that I don't really think he was a prophet, Bob.
Yeah. You and me both. So is it all right if I give a disclaimer?
Sure.
I'm not responsible for anything I say because you get me going and then it just comes out. So it's John's fault if I stick my foot in my mouth. It's like, you're dangerous for me because it's like there's a lot of stuff that sits inside my soul that I don't really share with people. But for some reason, I feel comfortable with you. And I, you know, for our audience out there, I mean, as I've shared often, you know, there's a perception, perspective, paradigm, meaning there's things that our five senses pick up, right? And then that gets formed into our perspective, and then it's a paradigm. It doesn't necessarily mean it's right, but what I'm about to share, or what John's going to get me to share, is my perspective. And you may have a different one. I know there's a lot of people out there that do, but this is my perception, and probably the perception of most people now in hindsight.
Yeah.
But yes, I ended up, John Paul was the third wheel of a tricycle. I call it the prophetic tricycle that came through KC in the 1980s. Most people are familiar with Bob Jones because he was probably the most critical in terms of formulating Mike Bickle's thinking and mine for a large part initially as to what our purpose was and where God was taking us and how what we were doing was going to turn into a movement and going to be transformative. And, you know, for two 25-year-old guys, you know, he was speaking our language, like he was reinforcing to us that we were going to be significant and impactful and change the world. So we ate it up. You know, we were wannabes, and he was telling us that what we wanted to be was going to happen. So we were very vulnerable to him. And then, of course, came along Paul Kane later in the 80s. And that's a whole wild story there. But then this guy, John Paul Jackson, kind of wandered in. And the three of them couldn't have been more different. You know, Bob was a roly-poly tree trimmer who basically had very little command of the English language, very street smart, but he's the kind of guy you would take your friend to his house so you could get a word from Bob, and he'd come out of his bedroom with his lime green socks and his slippers and his fat tummy hanging out of his t-shirt. I mean, he was a slob, right? Then you had Paul Kane, who was the refined, you know, latter-day rain, you know, kind of slick Pentecostal kind of, you know, he was the quintessential Pentecostal preacher. His hair was always perfect, you know. So there was that, right? But he was the elder statesman. The other guys and everybody else was totally intimidated by him because he had some strange giftings that were kind of wild. And then John Paul Jackson showed up. And John Paul Jackson was probably the most like Mike Bickle. JP came from Larry Lee's church. Does that name ring a bell to you, Larry Lee? So Larry Lee was a pastor from Rockwall, Texas, who was kind of into prayer before Mike. And so Larry was very well known in the 80s for his focus on prayer, had a, you know, very well known. There was another guy on our staff by the name of Tim Golden, who later passed away in a traffic accident. He was from Larry's church and had come up here because he had kind of helped Larry launch some of the prayer stuff, and he wanted to be a part of it. Mike felt Larry didn't go far enough. You know, Mike was, you know, whatever we did, whatever Mike did, he always outdid everyone else. I mean, that's one of the classic personality temperaments of Mike, right? If you did 10, he would do 15, right? If you did, right? Everything was a competition. Everything was one, right? So if Larry did this, I'm going to take it to the next level. So Mike's thing was 24-hour, 7 days a week prayer. You know, Larry was prayer meetings at night. Mike was going to go, you know, 24-7, 365. So that was that. JP was slick. Very slick. The most artistically creative of the three. Everything JP did was excellent. Excellent. I mean, if you go back and look at his materials from the 1980s, I mean, it's just, I mean, he had it down. I mean, he was a marketing, you know, very talented marketing-wise. But he had an ego so big that he was hard for me to handle. He and I butted heads constantly. Constantly butted heads. I mean, he was just so driven, you know what I mean? It was just like, ah.
You also bring out the bad side of me. I open up. This is a historical podcast, and I find with you, I give my opinions more than the other co-host. But you know,
and there are opinions. Just so everybody knows, there are perspectives. We're not telling you have to agree with us. We're just telling it from our side of the spectrum, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm going to give some details in the history of the movement, and this part is historical, but I'm going to throw some of my opinion in it. Because really, there's no way to prove either way. The only thing that we can say is we know what happened. We don't know how it got from point A to point B, but if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck. One of the problems with the prophetic movement is this. Anybody can do it. Mm-hmm. You walk out into a stage and you say, I was hearing from God and thus. But the problem is, your general audience, even back then, is not going to believe you. You have to convince them that you are a prophetic person. You either have prophecy or dreams, like John Paul Jackson. You have to convince the people of doing this. Well, how do you do this? You have to have a witness. You have to have somebody who says, oh, yes, he prophesied this thing way back when.
Right.
Because most of these people, especially with a dream, there's really no way to prove that you had the dream, right? And if you mention the dream after the event happened, well, who's to say that you didn't make it up, right?
Right.
I recently, I've mentioned this a couple times, I recently watched the Mike Winger video on Chris Reed. And Chris Reed is holding up his phone saying, look, I had this prophecy and this Apple note has this date on it at the top, and therefore I had this prophecy before the event. And he was it was a prophecy about Mike Winger, obviously. And Mike Winger held up his phone and says, yes, I can change the date on my phone, and 10 years ago I prophesied that you would be doing this to me. And so you have to have a credible witness. I'm going to say it like that. It has to be a credible witness. Well, how best to do it? Then you find other prophets. I've often asked the question, why the Kansas City prophets, plural, if Mike Bickle was the showman? Well, you have to have the voice of two or three witnesses, right?
Yeah.
Now, combine that with what William Branham did historically. One of his gimmicks was he told everybody that I was born under a sign on this year in 1909, and everywhere I went, I would have a witness. I would have a confirmation. He would say, these mystic women, and he's talking about, you know, the fortune tellers in the little crystal ball booth and in these places. He says, everywhere I went, these mystic women would call me out of the crowd and say, did you know you were born under a sign?
Right.
And everybody thought that this is proof that he was born under the dang sign, but nobody actually ever saw the fortune teller. And nobody stopped to think, wait a minute, is a fortune teller really something that you need to use as confirmation of a Christian ministry?
Well, to your point, I remember with, and you can maybe shed some light on this, but Paul Kane talked about being born with a skin over his face.
Yeah.
I guess in Pentecostal circles, that's kind of a sign or something. Explain that to me, because I wasn't real clear on what that meant, but I guess that's a sign that the child is special or something.
This is one of the funniest things, man. I've never talked about this, and this is it's going to be embarrassing, so I'm going to open up a little bit.
All right. Enlighten us.
In the South especially, you had this wide swath of people, both Christian or not, who were superstitious, especially during the spiritualist craze. They were superstitious about everything. And there was the idea that your child could be marked. You could say something and mark your child. And there was the idea that your birth, your whatever happened at your birth, superstitiously, was the path and trajectory of your life. And so Branham says, I was born under a sign. He says, when I was born, God spoke from, I can't remember how he phrased it, but essentially something supernatural allegedly took place in one of the later revisions to his stage persona. But there was the idea that you could either mark your baby by talking about it, you could give it a curse, or something would happen supernatural that would mark your baby for spiritual significance. And that's what they were doing.
Okay. Interestingly, but what's the skin over your face or something? I never did understand. I'm thinking, well, everybody's born in a sack. Like, was it left over? Like, what was the veil, or they call it the veil or something? I just listened to some of the old Pentecostals talk, and I heard Paul mention it once, and I never did quite understand what he was actually talking about, other than the fact that it meant you were a seer if you were born with that.
There's different, and I don't know the exact history on where all of that came from, but there's different ways to understand it. What he was probably trying to say was, I was born without being able to fully see, and I had to rely on my second sight. That's what he was trying to say. But regardless of all of this, the fact of the matter is, these guys had to have a witness of some sort. Right. And so John Paul Jackson, while he's now revered as his own thing, he was really just one of the voices to confirm Mike Bickle. Right. And without those, Mike Bickle would have been nothing.
Right. Well, and that's why Mike collected them. You know, I mean, we've talked about this in the past, because there's nothing new here. This is what political leaders have done for millennia, right? Which is, there's all these two power segments in every culture, which is politics, right? Who's ruling, and the spiritual leaders. And so the idea is that the political leaders always want the blessing of the religious leaders, because that reinforces the fact that they're chosen by God. So this has been going on. I mean, it's all through the Bible. There's nothing new here. There was the same thing was happening at KCF. Mike was rallying around him, you know, the religious leaders who spoke for God, that we were reaffirming his special stature and place in God's divine plan. So I'm like, okay, I've seen this play before. So getting back to JP, what's interesting is JP was from, I call him JPJ. I don't even call him John Paul. It's just too long. So he was known as JPJ. JPJ was born in Waxahachie, Texas, you know, and of course, Paul Kane was from around the Waco area. So they sort of had an affinity for that. You know, they were country boys from that south of, Dallas, you know, Fort Worth area, you know, like an hour south of that. That's where they were from. So they got on really well. But JP was so, like Mike, he was consumed. Well, again, this is my perspective, but they were both men who had what I call inverted pride. And inverted pride to me is defined as somebody who's painfully insecure, who is doing everything they can to reinforce how special they are, you know. And you see this a lot in Pentecostalism, where men come from very impoverished backgrounds. They're ashamed of their past, right? And then they get around power and money, you know, status and stuff. And suddenly they're redefining themselves. They're special, right? It's, but they're fighting their own childhood demons of being less than the poor kid who never had shoes or never had new shoes or wearing, you know, like the Bickle kids were all wearing hand-me-downs or Salvation Army stuff, you know, yeah. to school, right? So you're, you know, you're kind of, well, JP was like that. He was so trying to overcompensate for things that, because I have a sixth sense about things, it just rubbed me. Like, really rubbed me the wrong way. He and I tell you, this is a funny story. I felt bad. This is bad and good at the same time. This is one of these very conflicted stories. But we had a group of elders in our church. We called it the Senior Council. There was five of us. And so we would take these leadership retreats. So we happened to take one during the Super Bowl. I don't remember what year it was. All I do remember was it was the Denver Broncos playing the Washington Redskins. So we got, you know, it's all guys, or, you know, we got our food, we're watching the game, and Denver just comes flying out. They have so much energy that they're up 14-0 in the first quarter. And JP gets up in front of the whole thing, you know, the whole group, and goes, "God showed me. I told you guys this was going to happen." Like, he's just like, he, and he's pacing back and forth like the peacock, right? I call him prophetic peacocks. So he's doing his strut with his tail out, right? And it's like, he is just bragging. And I'm just sitting over in the corner after he gets done, you know, just going off. I kind of raise my hand and real timidly and go, "You know, I don't know. I have a funny feeling." And they're all, guys are all looking at me, "What do you mean?" I go, "It feels like to me that Denver came out with way too much energy, and that I think they're going to lay an egg." They never scored the rest of the game, and Washington scores 40 points and just crushes them, right? And JP is so humiliated. He wouldn't talk to me for 6 months.
Wow.
Oh, he was so mad. And I was like, there was a part in that was like, yes, you know, my male ego was like, yes. But then my compassionate side was like, I so humiliated him. I felt so bad. You know what I mean? It was one of those kind of things. But he was always creating those kind of situations, that he was always putting me in the most awkward situation. Well, finally, you know, before he left to go to New Hampshire or wherever it was to go start his own thing, he and I kind of had it out, you know, and we ended up, funny enough, kind of not ever becoming friends, but we ended up kind of coming to a place of peace and mutual respect. But he, I had some problems with him. My primary problem that I struggled with was not so much his personality as much as it was just, you know, I'm not into peacock preachers. Was the fact I didn't think he was a prophet. And so this is where it gets really tricky. In fact, to be quite honest with you, I went from being told by everyone that these three guys were prophets to actually, by probably 87 or 88, going, "I don't think any of these guys are prophets. I will defend all of them on the fact that they had very interesting insight. I mean, to the point of specific details sometimes that they couldn't possibly have known. So they were gifted. I will not, and yes, we've talked about the fake stuff because that was there too, but there was something genuine that I saw because I was in situations, not JP, but the other two, Bob and Paul, I saw things happen that I was like, whoa, there's no way he could have known that happened on the other side, or nobody knew or whatever, right? JP was a different story. He was so driven, and since he was, you know, he needed to be sensational, you know, and this was always kind of one of my big gripes with Mike, is why does everything have to be a three-wing circus, right? This was the whole purpose behind this vision I had for a place called Shiloh. I wanted to desensationalize it, right? I wanted to do all this in private because I had watched what was happening publicly, and then I watched what happened one-on-one. And I'm telling you, John, it was like two different worlds. Who those guys were and what they did to some of the people that I was doing my Joseph Company stuff with, key figures around the world, with how they interacted with these guys one-on-one was profound. What happened on the stage was it was like, wow. And here I am. I'm observing all this, right? Because I'm new to all this. And I'm like you. I'm analytical, right? I'm evaluating all of this as it's happening, trying to figure out, where's this going? Is this wise? Whatever. And that was one of my takeaways. So I was like, these guys don't belong on a stage. What they do belong in is in a counseling environment. Like Bob Jones helped me do in my counseling world, he accelerated the process of counseling sometimes 2 and 3 years. He was like this little catalyst, right, that gave a clue to something that a psychologist would peel back onion layers, right, to get to a year later, right? Okay, now we know what the real root issue. He'd just go right there. And then we could deal with it then, right? And I was like, wow, it's like this. It's like one of these things with him where it'd be like suddenly he just move everything forward in time, right? That's what I remember. It was like, that was so helpful. But nobody saw it. It was just three of us or maybe four of us in a little room out in Independence, Missouri. That was it, you know, and they loved him because he zeroed in things from their childhood, experiences they had, things that they'd never told anyone, you know, abuse situations that they'd held secret of, and boom, he was right there. So it was like, whoa, right? I never had any of that with JP, ever. JP was always like, he had that P.T. Barnum thing that Mike did. Everything was a show, right? So everything was slick, whatever. Here's where I'm going to get myself in trouble, where we can talk about this, but I probably just need to say it. In my view, most of what I've observed in the Pentecostal charismatic world that has been labeled prophecy is, to me, female intuition. Or you could say male. It's not that males don't have intuition, but by and large, it's been my experience now that I'm almost 70, that most women are incredibly intuitive. That's like, they just know, right? And moms are like intuitive on steroids. Like, moms know things that are just crazy. Like, they don't even have to be in the same state as you, and they know something's wrong, right? So how do they know? What is that? I don't know. I can't define it other than to say it's intuition. But it's there. It's a reality. There is a dynamic that happens with women who have what I call an open soul, right? They're loving, they're compassionate, they're caring. You know, I think of what it says in the Bible, Jesus was moved to compassion, therefore he healed, right? There's something about compassion that unlocks certain realms, right? People get healed with compassion. People get moved, right? So women, by nature, are compassionate and caring, not all, but most, and moms in particular, and they have an intuitive knowing. What I've seen with mothers and their children or women in situations are at the same level as what I see at church as prophecy. And I'm sorry if that offends people, but that's my observation, brother. I mean, you know, when Bob came to KCF, of course, everybody wanted to be prophets, right? Because Mike put him on stage and said, this is what gets you on stage. So suddenly now I've got 500 prophets in the church, and people are all, I felt God, right? Everything was I felt, I sensed, right? All the same dynamics as a mom or a woman, right? And so that's where it got, now where this gets really weird, and this is where I'm going to get myself in huge trouble, but hey, that's what we do in this podcast. We get ourselves in trouble. This is why I have said to people in private for years, I do not think it's a coincidence that so many public prophetic people, you know, ministry people that are defined as prophetic, either effeminate or have an issue with homosexuality. Now, again, this is a theory. It's not a fact. It's an observation. But I have seen the same dynamics that I have seen with females and mothers and intuition that I have with the prophetic guys. And then it comes out later or whatever. Was JPJ gay? I don't know. But I will tell you that I probably had a dozen women in the church that all insisted that he was. There was nothing that ever came out that he was. There was he was never accused of it. You know, I mean, I shouldn't say that. There was nobody, you know, where in the other situations there was a victim that came forward and said I was abused. I don't know if that ever happened. It didn't happen with me. Maybe somebody else has a story, but it never happened with me. But the kind of intuitive women all sensed that he was. He had a real problem with women. He is probably, if he had one, I mean, besides the fact that he was a wannabe kind of fake prophetic guy, his other big issue is he was a misogynist. And I had huge problems in my church with him. I mean, you know, and he came from that whole school of thought, if you disagree with me, you're a Jezebel. So he was very cruel to women. And there was various rumors flying around about verbal abuse and things like that. I know the people that worked for him, very dear friends for many, many years, and they're very damaged. Very, a lot of pain there. Because he was like Mike. You, in JP's world, you were a cog in his machine, right? You came to work for him, but you were serving the man of God, right? You know, that whole kind of weird concept, like, I'm God's chosen, and aren't you lucky to be with me, you know? And so that was where he and I got sideways. So bless his heart. It's hard for me to talk about it because he's dead and he died of cancer. And, you know, I hate talking badly about people that aren't here to defend themselves, right? But at the same time, I think we owe it to our audience to just be honest about our perceptions of things. So that's a long rant, but that's my perspective.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. You know, it's funny that you mention it in the way that you did, because that ties with some other research that I'm doing currently. I don't know if you know this history or not. Jim Jones was prophesied over by a female prophet in the Latter Rain movement, and that's what launched his ministry. In the Latter Rain, the way that you were ordained as a minister, you didn't need credentials, you didn't even need to know theology, you just had to have somebody lay hands on you and say, you are the next minister. Okay. So he had this female do this for him. And with Hobart Freeman, who is another destructive cult leader that brought many, many people to their death from Indiana, not far from Jones, actually. Hobart Freeman, also the same kind of thing. He mentions Anna Schrader was the lady who apparently prophesied over him. There's an interesting part of the ministries when you look at them during the Latter Rain movement. You had all of the Mike Bickles. You had William Branham. He was the foremost leader of the movement, and he had his own ministry, and everybody looked to him independently from, say, William Freeman. He had a different ministry, a different prophetic ministry, and these were the key figures. These were the Mike Bickles. But behind them, like I said, you had to have these voices of confirmation. Without the voices of confirmation, there's nothing. There were females who were the confirmationists, and Anna Schrader was one of these people. They when they wanted to rise up into power, there was always somebody to say, I had a prophecy, and that prophecy is just like mine. When you do this, people are sitting there, they don't question, did you really have a prophecy too? They just think, oh, this is the mouth of two or three witnesses. And to the devastation of the movement, they abused the mouth of two or three witnesses in many cases. That's my opinion. I can't prove it. I can't prove that somebody is intentionally lying. What I can prove is that some of the figures, like Jim Jones, there's no way that God spoke through this woman and said, this guy's a good guy. Let's get him platformed. Let's get him a ministry. There's just no way. Hobart Freeman, same thing. And when you look at some of the alleged prophecies of confirmation, you can go on Amazon right now. You can type in Anna Schrader, and you can find one of her prophecies of the end of the world. And she was considered one of the voices that backed the Old Testament-style prophets that were preaching doomsday in the communist scare.
So you know, there's an Anna that was doing that. You know who it was?
No.
Anna Kane.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have heard that.
Yeah, see, this is one of the things I figured out later with Paul, was she was that Pentecostal woman, right, who saw herself as a prophetess. And, you know, and of course, her favorite prophet was her own son, right? So she was the one that was, but I mean, that relationship between her and him, I mean, wow. I mean, I've never seen a more, what's the word? I know there's always a bond between a mother and a child, but this was like at a whole nother level. Like Paul freaked out. Like he just, if there was any sort of sense of separation between her and him, he'd just lose it. Like he needed her. She was everything. Like his whole sense of self and identity and everything came from her. Like she was, right? But then she was very influential in prophesying and many other leaders in the movement. You don't hear a lot about it because Paul, you know, kind of gets all of the press, but she was that mom, right? Who basically said, you know, you're chosen, son. You're a miracle.
If you have a movement that is familiar with this thing, see, I did not know any of this existed. I came after the movement, right?
Right.
But back in the day, apparently you had female voices that would back the male voices. And some of that goes back to Amy Semple McPherson. She was considered to be one of the elite Pentecostal females. What's interesting is a lot of those movements morph to, we can't have female ministers. not realizing, and you can't have, in Branhamism, you could not have a female prophet in the version that I grew up in. But in his previous days, Anna Schrader was one of the female prophetesses, right? So you had all of these voices. But what's interesting, and I'm going to say this with John Paul Jackson too, what's really interesting, these people who were the Mike Bickles of the movement, not the John Paul Jacksons, but the big guys, they presented themselves as Old Testament style prophets. And the way that they presented their ministries was that this is an addition to our Bible. It's not, you know, replacing the Bible, but this is the new book of Acts, basically. And our book of Acts is more like an Old Testament book of prophets and prophecies and prophetic histories. The problem is, if you go back and you look through some of the so-called prophecies, they're long forgotten because either A, they're incorrect, B, they have no relevance to today, C, they have no relevance to Christianity whatsoever. Right. Anna Schrader's book that you can get on Amazon is talking about the doomsday prophecies that she had during the 50s and 60s, of which none of them really are applicable today. And she's long forgotten. You don't don't really think about Anna Schrader. Nobody hears that name, right? But she was the one confirming all of the Mike Bickles of the era who are preaching, Russia's going to invade. We're going to all die soon. Get your soul prepared. Come to the altar and give me your money because you won't need it. We're going into the afterlife.
Isn't that interesting? Wow. Yeah. You know, going back to, I think a few weeks ago, I shared this. I can't remember what it's Ecclesiastes, though, and where Solomon goes, in many dreams and visions is emptiness, fear God. You know, my issue has never been whether prophecy is or isn't real. My issue has been this thing has been so exaggerated and so misused and so whatever that it's sort of like a gem, right? What makes a gem is it's rare, right? Prophecy, I think, for most people, and I could be wrong here, but at least in my circles, in my age group, it's most people roll their eyes. It's just like it's lost its impact, right? God, thus saith the Lord, gets most people when they hear that just turn off, going okay, or I had a dream, or any of those little lead-ins to sort of bolster what's coming next, just basically turns most people off because, again, you know, we're older, so we've seen so much, right? I think it still happens, but I think it's rare. It's like the real word of God, I think, is actually rare. I don't mean the word of God like the printed word of God. I'm talking about whatever. I think it's so completely misused. And I would say, in my view, based on what I've seen after, you know, nearly 50 years in ministry, I'd say 90% of what's considered prophecy isn't, or prophetic. I just think it's people's opinion with thus saith the Lord in front of it, you know. It's their perspective. Valid, you know. It's kind of like, you know, I remember I got myself in trouble in the 1980s because I was struggling with this. And my question, you know, JP and these guys, they'd have these little prophetic groups, right? They were, you know, going to raise up prophets. And I was like, well, why do you guys got to say, thus saith the Lord? Or why do you have to put, I had a dream? Why can't you just say it? And then if it happens, we all know, wow, we'll come back and go, how did you know that?
Yeah.
And you can get, well, God showed me, right? But instead, we get 90% of your opinion with God, you know, with, you know, in the, what's in the casing of religious prophecy, right? You know, you've encased it in this. So now we can't say, I don't believe you, because now we're, you know, I don't believe God. I mean, it was that whole thing. And I go, you're putting people in very awkward positions because you're so insecure, because almost every prophetic person I've ever met is painfully insecure, right? And so it's like, you know, brother or sister, I'd be like, hey, you know, I understand you're scared. I understand all of what's going on from what's going on in your soul, but you're creating this me versus you kind of dynamic here. Why don't you just bring it and say, I have this, you know, I've been feeling something, I've been sensing something, and let us all listen and evaluate and look at it, right? I've one of the visions behind this whole Shiloh thing that never happened was that I believe Paul was right when he said we see in part, we see dimly, right? My feeling was that I just didn't feel like God entrusted anyone with the whole picture. I felt like he gave us all a piece, that we're all a part of, you know, like Paul talks about the body, uses that whole analogy about the body, you know, some are this, some are that. Well, to me, the key to the whole thing was, well, if we could get all these different kind of people around a round table and everybody just sort of shared what they've been sensing, somewhere there's a composite word in here. Like there's some, maybe there's something here, some wisdom in all of this, if we put this all together. But no, what we end up with was all these little siloed, you know, ministries, right? As all these guys are all trying to make a name for themselves and generate some income. And so it's all fractured. There's not a whole, you know, there's not a wholeness to it. So anyways, that was always my dream, and do it in private. And then after, you know, some time of getting everybody together and putting it all together, then, you know, share something that's full, that's well-rounded, that's got a lot of different perspective, you know. I remember a friend of mine who worked for the government said to me, she goes, you know what's bad about working for the federal government? I go, what's that? She goes, every time you solve a problem, you create another one. She goes, you never win. because when you fix one problem for one group, you create a problem for another group, right? And it's sort of like that, you know, that was my whole thing. Well, then that's like, can I saw that in the church world as well. So I don't know. It's sad in a way because I'm nearly 7 years old and I still have this thing in my soul, like, who are the real prophetic voices? Because I believe the world needs them. I believe, and to me, so again, I see everything in word pictures. So to me, the role of prophets is like signposts on a highway, right? In other words, they're not the road. They're not the journey. But along the way, they're saying, and this is what they did, right? I mean, if you go back and you look, you know, what did Old Testament cover, you know, they told you, hey, here's where the destination is, right? This is, you know, this is where you're going. Hey, you've just, you know, there's danger over here. Don't take like, this exit or the road's closed, right? They were giving you warnings or you've just gone the wrong way. You're headed down a wrong road, right? So to me, the prophets were always like signposts going, hey, culturally, right? Because who were they talking to? They were talking to the whole nation, to the people. It wasn't necessarily just, I mean, the kings always sought them out for counsel. But by and large, what you read, you know, the prophecies that are in the Bible, they're to a whole group of people basically saying, hey, you know, somehow you got off the, you know, you got off the chosen path here. I mean, you had a destiny this way and you're over here. Like you're way off the reservation. You're in trouble here. If you keep going, right, and you cross these boundaries, you know, it's ruin on the other side. So that's what they're doing, right? They're just keeping people on the highway, moving in the right direction. And I don't see that. That's, you know, I mean, I do see it, but it's not coming from the church world. That's why I've said before, I know people laugh at me, but I think Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was a Russian dissident who spoke at Harvard in the 1970s and warned America about everything that's happening now, way back then. And it said, if you're not careful, and his big point was, what you think, you know, his big point to Americans where you think freedom is your most important value, but in reality, it's security because you'll sacrifice your freedom to feel safe. And that's exactly what we did after 9/11. It's that kind of thing. Like he was prophesying in a way where we were headed and what the dangers were. And there's been other ones like that as well that have come forward, you know. I just don't see that in the church world. It's like this carnival thing. Come to the meeting, you know, put your quarter in the machine and the great Swami is going to spit out a prophecy for you. It, you know what I mean? It's like it's not serious. And I guess, and again, I don't want to demean people that are getting, you know, that feel like, you know, they got a word from God, but I'm just saying it's like we're at kindergarten level prophecy and we're all proud of that. And I'm like, wait a minute, you know, I want something a little bit more meatier here. Where are the voices? You know, not my last book, but the one before that, where I talked about, you know, what was coming, you know, in 2000, I'd been holding on for a decade and I finally released it in 2000 talking about AI and what's coming and what all the pitfalls, right? I don't claim to be a prophet, but the book was prophetic because everything that I wrote in the book is all happening. Right. And it was all a warning, like not that we shouldn't do this, but if we do this, this is what's going to happen. And these are all the issues. And the reason why I got no traction with the religious leaders is because I said in the book, the religious leaders are absolutely ill-equipped to deal with what's coming.
Here's my problem with not just John Paul Jackson, but as I mentioned, there's many other people who were doing this for the Mike Bickles of the movement. And it goes back to something you said, talking about the boundaries. How do you define the line between what these guys are doing and what Christianity is? And also, you talked about seeing in part. Not many people give John Paul Jackson the credit that he should be given for swaying the prophetic movement in what is, my opinion, the wrong direction because of the seeing in part thing. So I'm sitting here, I've had a heck of a week this week. My desk is a mess. It's usually pretty clean. But I can look around my desk and I can tell you everything on it. There's the gum. Mm. There's the coffee cup. There's the dirty coffee cup. I can see everything, right?
Right.
If you believe in an all-knowing, all-powerful God that sees everything, and at the same time, you understand what a prophet is. A prophet is a voice, a mouthpiece that God is speaking through. Mm-hmm. Well, God knows everything. He knows he's seeing right now. He's seeing the future. He's seeing everything in its accuracy.
Right.
John Paul Jackson is one of many voices of affirmation that push the notion that seeing in part, this we see things now in part, means that if I give a prophecy and one or two details of that prophecy are true, run with it. Ignore the rest that's not true, right?
Yeah.
And he did this. I don't know if he did it purposefully, because this did match Branham's strategy. Maybe he got it from Paul Kane, maybe not. Paul Kane would have known because he was around Branham. Branham pushed the same idea because he was trying to uplift mysticism to compare it as the counterpart to Christianity. And so that's why he would mention the mystic woman. We see the mystic woman, and she could see in part that I had these stars, a line above my head whenever I was born. So she could see in part, but she couldn't see everything because she could only see some things. Well, John Paul Jackson, if you go back through his dreams, I can't remember the name of the program, but the program he had, he would say things like, and we talk about the Christian mystics that are seeing these things. And he gives names, a bunch of Catholic names that no Protestant is going to reverence in the same way that he's doing. But he's trying to point to the fact that they could see in part because they got some of the details correct in their prophecy.
Right.
This swayed the whole prophetic movement because of this in the modern version, the modern reiteration of Latter Rain. Well, now you've got prophets that can have intuition, and that intuition is that something's going to happen.
Right.
And almost anybody can do that. You don't have to be a prophet to do this. I can watch, like you said, I can watch a football game and I can see if a team is doing poorly or getting too tired. And I'd say, it's my intuition that they're going to win. Well, all you have to do is say it, and if you give other details, well, it doesn't matter all of the details, but I got the one thing right that I could probably perceive. Well, that's how prophecy works in this movement. If they can come to some gut feeling, well, the gut feeling then becomes prophecy, but worse than that, because they're not the ones pushing the prophecy so much as it is the John Paul Jacksons of the movement. They don't even have to say it's prophecy. They just say something. I think the Chiefs are going to win today.
Oh, yeah.
Well, then you get the secondary tier, the John Paul Jacksons. If the Chiefs win, they come out and say, did you not see the Chiefs won? And I had a dream just like this. Well, if the Chiefs lose, they don't say anything. And so the supporting tier, I call in the pyramid of prophets, I call this the supporting tier that decides whether it's a prophecy or not. And that's really how the movement works.
Well, I got myself into trouble. This is terrible, but this is me. This is what got me kicked out of CCD at Catholic school, too. I was like, okay, you guys, like, why are all your prophecies in King James English? I'm confused here. Like, we're in America, we speak English, you know, why are we now back to 1600s, you know, British English here? Is it like heaven stuck? Like heaven doesn't know what language we speak now? So God spoke to you, thus saith the Lord, right? Really, right? Then the second thing always was for the ones that had visions. Why are angels always dressed like they're in the first century? Like, why are they always in white robes and all that? Is there like no clothing budget in heaven for like modern clothes? Right? I'm sorry, but this is the way why would God be appearing, you know, like in things 2,000 years ago? It's like, why couldn't God show up, or an angel show up in a three-piece suit and a briefcase, right? Why did you see what I mean? Why? I don't understand all this. Like, this doesn't make sense to me. It's like we're stuck. And then that's where you start going, well, wait a minute. This is where your perspective, right? Perception, perspective, paradigm, right? So if you're being told your whole life, all these Bible stories, about, and you grew up in a King James Bible, or you had all these pictures when you were little kids about angels in white robes, and all, right? So you perceive that. That became your paradigm of what heaven looks like. And so now when you speak from that perspective, right? Because it's become a locked-in paradigm. Except for we don't live then. We're not in 2000. We're not in 1 AD, right? We're not even in 100 AD. We're in 2026. Like, what's going on here? Why can't heaven appear to us like modern? Mm-hmm. Why? Right? I don't understand that. See, and it's still in my head. I struggle with this all the time. It's like, well, wait a minute. If God was going to show up now, why can't he speak like we're speaking now? Right?
Yeah.
Why can't he look like us now? Right? It's like, are these angels or whatever? Why are they?
Well, so, it's a psychological technique. If you've got a movement that by and large is studying the King James Bible, which many of them are, if you talk in that language, they start to associate it with a biblical thing.
Right.
That's really why they do it. I can assure you that whenever people are sitting there with all of their critical thinking disabled and they hear the Queen's English, their mind, without even thinking, their mind goes back to the Bible. So it further reinforces everything that is said.
See, these are part of my struggles, right, with modern church prophecy. I've said this before, you know, if you see prophecy as prognostication, like if that's your primary focus on it, well, the church prophets have a horrible batting average, like, you know, like your lady that you were talking about earlier. I mean, they get it all wrong. The people who are batting high batting averages are the writers and screenwriters in Hollywood. Because if you go back and look at movies 50 years ago, I mean, there's movies from the 1930s that describe the world that we're living in now. Heck, the Jetsons, which we grew up with, is the world that, I mean, none of these things in the Jetsons were even technically possible. And yet, here we are, and we're on the verge of Rosie's in our house every day. You know? I'm just saying, it's like these people were so far ahead, all right? They prognosticated, and they were right, right? The church world, there's nothing out there that I know of that can even touch anything like this, right? So we're stuck in the I sense, I feel, but then it all comes out with this perspective that's been entrenched from our religious upbringing. And so it's like, wait a minute here, something's off. Like we're, you know, again, it's, I'm not dis-, please don't misunderstand me. I am in no way disparaging prophecy. I want it more than anything. I just want something mature. And not sitting there celebrating and patting ourselves on the back because we're a bunch of little kindergartners that drew, you know, we can't even color in the lines. Like, we're so bad, right? It's indistinguishable. Yeah. Some of our prophecies. It's like, it just feels like we're children trying to pretend we're something more than we're not. And that really, that's, I guess, a pet peeve I've got. It really bothers me that it's like we're, and here's why I think, particularly it bothers me, because outside of our world, and you get outside a little church world, and you realize that everybody else that's looking in sees right through it, right? It's like you think you're being influential, and actually, they're laughing at you. Like, it's just, this is embarrassing, right? Because they see right through all of the facade. They see the show. They see all of it, and they're just like, this is sad. And so to me, I want to see people come into the King. I want to see people have a relationship with God. I want to see all that. But in order to do that, we've got to have something that's authentic and genuine and real. And that typically doesn't happen on a stage, in my experience. I have seen it with my own eyes. I can tell you, I have got hundreds of stories about what happens away from a crowd. And it's profound. What I don't see is it on a stage. That to me, it's they've turned it into a show. I mean, I'll get myself in trouble for this, but if you took prophecy away from Chris Reed, would anybody show up at his church? Right. And you see what I'm saying? In other words, like, is this another night? You know, this gets back to, I was talking to my friend this week about who's actually in the business world, one of my Joseph guys. And we were talking about how the business consultants came in the 1980s. He was right there with me. We watched John Maxwell, you know, who was in the Christian world or in the secular world, come into the Christian world, all these different consultants, right? And we watched the whole shift from caring for people to putting on the show, right? In fact, somebody sent me, I have to send it to you, somebody sent me a meme the other day. It was hilarious about this church consultant going off about your coffee's in the wrong place or something. Yeah. It was like, you know, it's just, it's all about the show and the presentation, right? And, you know, sticky relationships. I mean, all these business terms that you and I hear all the time in our meetings. And it's just, that's what's become church. And so now we got to have the sensational, you know, that's what P.T. Barnum did, right? He always went around the world to find the freakiest thing he could find, you know, to get the big attraction. There was always one big attraction, right? I mean, he had lots of stuff in his little museum or whatever, but he always had that one, you know, Tiny Tim or whoever it was, you know. He had the one, the hook, as we say in music, right? The marketing hook. And I look at it and I go, God, it's all the same thing in the church world now, right? The prophetic guys, they got their hook. They have that thing. They know exactly what to say, you know. And to your point earlier about this lady, what every prophetic and ministry guy knows is Christians are scared. Fear is a huge motivator in the Christian community, right? I mean, the Catholic Church used it for years to scare people into obedience, right? Out of fear. If you don't this, you're going to hell. Right? The evangelical world, if you don't do this, you're going to hell, right? If you don't obey, if you dance, you're going to hell. I mean, it was just fear, constant fear, 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 right? So fear is, you know, that's one, right? Now what's happening is the church world is dealing with social media, entertainment, right? We've become an entertainment-driven culture now. We are all on our phones. Why? I sit there and watch it in the airports, whatever. They're all, everyone's on their phone watching videos. They're on, look at TikTok, right? It's just, you know, 30-minute, two, you know, quick video, 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 one after another. It's like, be entertain me. So that, you know, that's what the church leaders are up against. I want to go be entertained. You know, give me the show. And so it's not all their fault. Sometimes it's us putting pressure to go be entertained.
Well, I knew you would have an opinion. And before going into this, my opinion was that Jackson wasn't really that important as the loudest prophet. That there are other people. Like I said, you had this tier of prophets or dreamers or whatever you want to call them.
Right.
But he helped normalize that system. And he helped kind of bring back what was pre-existing from the movement as it was in the days gone by. So
he was the biggest showman of the three.
Absolutely.
For sure. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would say that's why I say he and Mike were two peas in a pod. They were both at that P.T. Barnum thing. So he was all about sensationalism, JP. It was always, you know, big, you know, go, what's that phrase? Go long or go large or whatever it is. That was him and Mike. Just, you know, outdo everyone else, right?
Go big or go home.
Yeah, exactly. That was JP. And so, you know, he was like one of those home run hitters in baseball. They strike out three times and then hit one home run. But man, when he whiffed, it was bad. I mean, I cleaned up so much damage he did. Whew.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
Yeah, it was tough. Well, I mean, again, I don't want to disparage things, but again, we need to have honest conversations. You know, if we're ever going to move forward as a community of people, we have to be honest, you know, and this isn't a criticism. So just so people understand, I differentiate criticism and critique. I find criticism very unappealing because it's just about tearing people down, and I'm not really into it. What I'm into is critique, and critique is what we do in the business community when we evaluate it. In some cases, we call it a post-mortem when you lost a deal or something, and you sit down, you evaluate, and you critique yourself, and go, why did this not work? And so this whole session we've had talking to each other as good buddies is about critiquing things. Let's look at this. Let's turn over the rocks. Let's have honest conversation about it. Not to be critical of John Paul, but let's look at this and learn from it, and let's do better the next time if we can.
Absolutely. Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.